Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Laura Galloway is my guest today with her memoir, Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra. Laura's wanderlust was sparked by a simple DNA test. She learned she was related to the Sami, the indigenous inhabitants of the Arctic tundra. And as they tend to, one thing led to another, and Laura moved from the hustle of New York to the silent tundra of Norway to live with a reindeer herder. This is a story of love and courage, of hope, of strength, ups and downs, and basically how adversity can strengthen our character. And it's also a love letter to the frozen landscape and the people of Norway. Laura Galloway began her career at the LA Times and holds a Master of Arts in Indigenous Journalism and a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science. This is her debut book, and again, it's called Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra. And here's my guest, Laura Galloway. Laura Galloway, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Vicki, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here because your book is about Norway, largely. It's part memoir, part love story to Norway and its people. But I love Norway myself, and so it instantly grabbed my attention. But tell us, where are you joining us from today?
So I live in the south of England now. I'm in Sussex.
Very nice, very nice. And you began your career as a journalist at the LA Times, doing what?
I actually started at the Times as a copy messenger and worked my way up as I went to university at the University of Southern California.
Okay.
Ended up writing for the paper.
Yeah. And so then how did you end up in New York?
So I ended up after some number of years, I was offered a job in New York for a company during the startup period of, you know, people were doing all sorts of online startups, and went to work for a company there that went bankrupt about 3 weeks after I arrived.
Oh my gosh.
That landed me in New York.
And so you left in New York without a job at that time then?
Yes.
Oh. God, welcome to New York.
I write about it in my memoir a little bit, but actually I think it's the perfect New York landing.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how life changed for you. I always like to share a little bit of background with our listeners first, but you know, you were in New York and your life did suddenly change. You went to a conference and received a gift bag, which was the start of a major turning point in your life. So tell us a little about that.
Right. So I had taken, I had been given in this gift bag an early stage DNA test. And this was many years ago now, but a commercial DNA test, which suggested that I had some genetic affiliation to the Sami people of the north of Norway. And this was really curious to me because I had thought that I was a very well-traveled person. I had never heard of Sami people. And I just didn't really understand what it meant or who these people were, and they are the indigenous inhabitants of northern Sweden, Finland, Norway, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. And so this really sparked a curiosity for me, and I started traveling to the area when I wasn't working and really fell in love with the Arctic.
Yeah, it has its own uniqueness. And I, too, had not heard of the Sami. So I Googled them, as we do these days, right? And I found there's four different types of Sami. And we'll get into that in just a little bit when we explain what happened next. But so you get this love of the Arctic, and you write in the book, which I think explains it perfectly. You say the Arctic North in winter is a great void, and maybe that's why you're so drawn to it. And you say, in its nothingness, there is no chaos, no ambiguity, nothing to be done except to be there. So tell us what that feels like when you're in that moment?
Well, I think it's incredible because I think people of a certain age will remember the world before we had the internet and everything was hyper-connected. And when you could go to cities and really not see the same things in every city, the same stores, the same Starbucks, what have you. And this was the first time in my life, probably since I had been in my early 20s, that I had an experience where everything was completely new to me and completely different and completely void. And I think we don't really realize how much we live our day-to-day lives in places that are so filled with things with which we are familiar. And this was really the magical draw for me to this part of the world initially.
Mm. And I want to just contrast that, if I can, with how you were feeling in New York, because you write there, and you write, in New York, you were breaking open and falling apart. And to reveal this weakness and vulnerability to anyone might have caused me to die of shame. How are you feeling then? Obviously, you were at a point where you needed to make change.
Yeah, I really was. I mean, a few things were happening at once, and I think that this is why it was really a big moment in my life, but I had lost a major client that I had worked with for a million years that kind of made my reputation, and they wanted to go with a bigger firm, and at the same time, I didn't know what I would do in the future as my job and my family situation, meaning my brothers and sisters and my situation with my parents, which much of my memoir kind of explores in tandem with my Arctic life. All of this was coming to a head at the same time. And I was also realizing in the moment that I just was living an entirely unsustainable life. Why am I doing what I'm doing? What's the meaning in my life? I mean, these were all things that were happening at the same time.
Yeah, and especially in a place like New York, because I do love New York, but I too also love the wilderness and the nothingness. Can appreciate both sides of that. And when you're in a place like New York, there's so much sensory input coming at you constantly. The only time it's not is when you're asleep, I think. So huge difference there. You mentioned your family, and you talk in the book of how your mother died when you were just 3 years old, and how this loss, trauma in anybody's life can shape them throughout their life. So do you remember your mom?
I do. I have very small snippets of memory with her, and I do exactly remember, as I write about in the book, when she died, because that was a big moment in my life. I was 3.5 years old, and I remember. I have very fragmented memories of her, but she did make an impression on me, obviously. Because she was my mother, and also because what followed after having my mother was completely different. So.
Right. So let's go back to when you have this DNA test and you get interested in the Sami and start traveling and doing more research and everything. And all of this leads ultimately to an affair with a reindeer herder. So tell us how you met a reindeer herder.
So I met Ailu, the reindeer herder, after I'd made several visits up to the north and Sweden and Norway. And I had a friend that said, well, you really have to go. A Norwegian friend said, you really have to go to Norway. And so I went to Norway, but I landed in a village called Karasjoka in Sami, or Karasjok in Norwegian. And my friend said, oh, you have to go to a Sami wedding, because these are actually the most spectacular weddings that you will ever see. About 1,000 people come to them. Everybody is dressed in their gakti, which is the Sami clothing, and the weddings last for a few days. And I went to this wedding, and this is where I met Ailu, the reindeer herder, and our eyes kind of locked across the room. And it was a very strange thing because I wasn't expecting to meet someone, but it just started off a relationship, and we stayed in touch. And he was ultimately the reason that I moved to his village in Kautokeino, or Gautokeino in Sami, and not to Karajak, where I was just going to stay for a few months to kind of figure out my life.
Now, this doesn't have Hallmark movie written all over it. I don't know what does.
Oh, no, don't say that.
No. In a good way. I mean, you know, I can see that they would make a movie from your book.
Okay, good.
No, I did mean that in a good way, Laura. I really did.
No, it's fine.
And so anyway, you leave New York and you go to live with him. And tell us about, you know, those first few weeks, because it's one thing, you know, we both know this because we've both traveled quite a bit. It's one thing to visit a place and spend a little time there. It's a whole other thing when you actually live and work and you know, sleep there every day. So what were those first few weeks like for you?
Well, that's the most on-target insight ever, Vicky. It's true. When you go to live in a place, when you have to deal with the day-to-day, it really, I think you could be in the most magical place on earth and it kind of rips off the varnish. For me, it was really interesting because I was in a place where you didn't have guidebooks or, you know, these are the cultural norms, because it's such a small culture. The reindeer herding Sami are about 10% of the population, and I was sort of in the middle of reindeer herding Sami culture, and the customs were totally foreign to me, and things that were actually, in most cases, completely the opposite of anything you would do in the United States, just in terms of visiting or personal space or making appointments. I was really amazed that so many people were coming to visit me when I first arrived. But then I realized, I thought this was something, you know, special and unique, but Sami people visit each other. You come to people's houses and you have coffee. You leave a pot of coffee on all the time, and you know, the door is always open, and you have very, very long, you know, visits that don't include conversation the whole time, which is hard for me as a Midwesterner and a New Yorker. So it was kind of learning a whole cultural code of conduct with nobody that could actually explain any of it to me.
Right.
It took a long time.
Right. Had you learned any of the language before you moved? I know a lot of them do speak English, but I'm not so sure about that far north.
I do. I mean, I think it's compulsory to learn English if you live in Norway, but I think if you're really far north, many people don't know that Norway has two specific, official languages, and it's not just Norwegian, but now it's also Sami language. And so a lot of people just exist on those two languages, but they also might speak Finnish or, you know, some Swedish, because these countries where the Sami exist in an area called Sápmi, the land borders are so close together that you have to have a little bit of knowledge of each. And Americans or British people don't often land in that part of the world.
Right, right.
So it was really more challenging. And I did not speak any of the language. So one of the first tasks was for me to enroll in school.
Yeah.
Learn Sami.
Yeah, I can't imagine. That's. I mean, I had enough of a language barrier when I moved from Britain to America. You know, I'd say things like,
"We understand you."
Where's the torch? Where's the torch?
And everybody. 3 years ago, but now I totally get it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the Sami, because I was fascinated reading about them. They have what they call the Skolt Sami, the Mountain Sami, the Sea Sami, and the Forest Sami. And they were oppressed for quite a long time until by several governments, until they started being accepted. Right?
That's right. The Sami people, I think, as I mentioned previously, the land borders they originally recognized way before the creation of modern nation states were a place called Sápmi, and that was part of Russia, Finland, the north of Norway, and Sweden. And these land borders changed everything for them. And also, when you create states, then you have taxation. And this really created, if you talk to any Sami person today, they have both identities. They're Swedish Sami or Norwegian Sami or Finnish Sami. But the way that will be articulated to you is, I am Sami from the Norwegian side. I am Sami from the Swedish side.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of the way of explaining your two identities, because I think that this part of the world is so different from anything that we look at or feel is you know, typical Scandinavian. It's just really a really different experience.
Yes, yeah. And so talk to us a little bit about the land, because the tundra, the land itself is so different. I remember when I was there, I mean, it was a little tidbit here, but it just fascinated me. We went out on a tour one day to look at an oil drill, of all things. But along the way, the tour guide told us, you could tell, not so much now, but, you know, in years past, who was rich and who was poor by whether the planks of wood on their house went upward or they went horizontal. So they were either vertical or horizontal. And if they were horizontal, you knew they were poorer because they could just, in the bad weather, rip out the bottom planks and replace them. But if they had vertical planks of wood around their house, if it was built that way, they were usually wealthier because you'd have to rip off, obviously, the whole front. You couldn't just replace a couple of planks at the bottom.
Wow, I'd never heard that, but that's fascinating. That's fascinating.
Yeah. What are some of the key points that you share with people as the main differences in cultures?
Well, you know, I think that we live in a very interconnected world, so I think the first thing is to say that Sami people are very modern people. They're, you know, in the North, I had faster internet than I've ever had in England, and you can particularly probably laugh at that, Vicky, but because we've tried to connect a couple of times. But they're really modern people, but they have their indigenous, you know, culture in addition to having this national culture. So it's a really interesting time for Sami people. And for Sami people and many indigenous people, the cultures are deeply tied to indigenous livelihood, which are sort of really tied into the land. And things, you know, jobs that have to do with working the land, such as herding reindeer, or if you're a sea Sami, fishing, or, you know, all of these things. So the culture is really, it's important for people to understand, first of all, the dichotomy of modern indigenous people, I think, and the complexity of the things that they're probably trying to reconcile in their existence on a daily basis. And I can only say, living around reindeer herders, it was really interesting because the commercial concerns of, let's say, Norway and Sweden are very different than the indigenous livelihood concerns. So indigenous are concerned with preserving land and doing things in the old way, like having space to herd reindeer. And, you know, modern concerns are, how do we do extraction for minerals, which make money, or build wind farms, which are also not a bad thing, but they do destroy indigenous ways of life.
Right. And you were definitely living a lifestyle. You talk about that in the book. You weren't just dating a Sami reindeer herder. You were living, you know, his life, basically. And one of the things you said is, never ask a reindeer herder when he'll be back when they go out with that reindeer. So,
yeah.
So they obviously have to travel a lot with this. Explain how that works. Because I was talking with someone and he said, well, to be honest, I never really understood that reindeer was still around, and I was lucky enough to see some in Norway. But so what was life as a reindeer herder like?
Well, so my partner was a reindeer herder, and I think, you know, it's a diminishing number of people that are following this livelihood. But the traditional reindeer herders have a very, very difficult life in front of them because they follow the path of nature and the reindeer. And that means they're following the reindeer to make sure that when they are up in the mountains, that they are well, you know, they're living, they're not being taken over by predators, that they're able to get to lichen, which is the essential food for them, which is an increasingly difficult thing for reindeer because we have an increasing abundance of permafrost, which reindeer can't get down to the food they need to eat. And so the herders, their job is to go up, you know, in the most bitter cold and winds and stay with the reindeer and to make sure that they are okay so that they can be driven in a couple of times a year, you know, down into the towns where they can be taken care of, inoculated, castrated, culled, or whatever needs to be done. But it's a harsh life. You would think that we live in such a connected world that you can use your cell phone or something, but you don't have cell coverage in many of the places they go. The weather can be brutal. They are on snowmobiles and dressing very warmly, but they are really taken from their ancestors in terms of, you know, not really having technology as a gigantic aid.
Yeah, and talking of technology, I mean, at some point, this reindeer herder sends you a message that he's kind of moved back to mommy and daddy's house, and you should move back to New York. Devastating, I would imagine.
I was. I mean, I felt very blindsided. He actually went up to the mountains instead of going back to his parents' house, and so there was really no way to reach him. But that's when I have the decision, do I go back to New York or do I stay here? And I really wanted to, you know, get upset and, you know, suffer over the breakup, but I just had too much stuff to do to kind of figure out, like, when I decided I'm staying, what I needed to do to survive day to day. And that even included stupid stuff like, how do I get firewood? Because even though I was kind of in a complete village, I had been living with a guy that lived from the 1800s.
Right.
So my view of everything that existed was his and not what really was. So I had a gigantic learning curve. And that was a challenge that at the time I didn't say, oh, this is wonderful, I love it. But in retrospect, I'm really grateful for that because I think we're not challenged enough in life.
Yeah, I think we don't choose to have these things thrust upon us, but I think those times when we face great adversity are the times when we have the opportunity to grow the most. And you know, certainly when I look back over my life, those challenging times are the times when I've made huge growth spurts. So in a way, it brings you to where you are today, right?
Yes, I think that's really, really true.
Yeah. So you started out as a journalist, you know, where you're reporting facts, you're reporting other people's stories. How difficult was it for you to really open yourself up and share your memoir, share the stories about your family and experiences?
It was very difficult. So I had no eye towards writing a book when I moved there. For a very brief period, I had thought about, I should write a blog because this was at the apex of the social media, take pictures of your food and, you know, report on cultures that you know nothing about. And I realized kind of pretty early on, and mostly because of my friend Stain, who's a newspaper editor that I write a lot about in my book, I just thought, this is ridiculous because I have not lived this experience, so how can I report on it? And this is really, I think, the bigger problem in the world right now. And I decided not to do anything at all. And then when I was getting ready to leave, I felt like I think anybody that writes in memoirs is kind of searching to make sense of their life and why their life went in a certain direction and to order it. I think writers want to sort of, you know, order things, and that's what I was doing. But I also felt it was really important because this was a place that I had fallen deeply in love with, and I wanted people to know about this culture. And I wanted people to know also that I had a really devastatingly, you know, in the context of my own life, a difficult path to independence. Mm. And I wanted people to see a way out. So,
yes.
It's hard to write that. And I changed everybody's name in the book and my family. And, you know, I'm still dealing with the fallout from my familial relationships. But, I mean, that's the price.
It's your story. It's your story.
Yes. Yeah.
I like Anne Lamott's phrase when she says, if you wanted to be written about warmly or something like that, you should have been better behaved. Words to that effect. You know, it's your story, write it. So your father, after your mother died, eventually got remarried to a woman who sounds very cold at one point. I mean, she made it pretty clear, it sounds as though you weren't really wanted, but she did decide to adopt you. And you talk later about how she didn't adopt your brother Will, and that caused you to feel even more alone, because that caused more rift there. So did that, I know you connected with your brother at some point, but did you reconcile, and has that situation healed?
With my brother or
with your brother?
Well, so not really. I mean, there are three children that were older that my stepmother did not adopt, and I think that, you know, I think the unfortunate thing about life is that we continue to sort of live out our scars in ways that we're not totally aware of.
Yeah.
And yeah, I had a lot of blame for all of my siblings for a very long time because I was much younger. Why didn't anyone protect me? But now I understand that, you know, they're all working through their own stories as well. And so you just have to have a lot of love for that. You know, I don't wake up as Mother Teresa, but I remind myself of that, you know, relationships are a work in progress and healing is a work in progress.
Absolutely. I love this in the book because the book is quite reflective. I mean, you know, you do seem to be examining your life and you know, how you got through things and how you move forward. And one of the things you say in the book is, I spend a lot of time reflecting on how much of our behavior is dictated by things that happened to us as kids. And in thinking about this, I try and picture the most hurtful people I know as children, imagining them as that rather than the adults they've become. And you go on to say, you know, how much of your life has been shaped by the hurt and loss that you felt as a child.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's very profound. And it's, you know, I've kind of learned to do that with certain people too. I see the hurt child in them, but it's not always easy, right?
No, and I also think it's really important to point out that you don't, you know, this is a real liability in a memoir when you have to finish things that seem very clean. You don't come to a point where, oh, I went to the Arctic and now I'm healed and everything's great. To be human is to continue to strive forward and trying to learn these lessons. But I feel like this sort of, you know, fleshed out a wound and helped me understand what I was dealing with in a better way, if that makes any sense at all.
No, it makes perfect sense. And one other thing I want to touch on to that is that you say that now you know that home is not a physical place, not a destination. Home is inside of you and all around you, but not in a brick and mortar sense. It's about people and connections. And it reminded me of Maya Angelou. She said, you only are free when you realize you belong no place. You belong every place, no place at all. The price is high, the reward is great. And
oh, you're giving me chills. What an amazing quote. I love her, but I never that I have never listened or heard that quote before or remembered it.
Yeah, it's one that I really connected with. But that's kind of how I when I was reading your book, I got that sense from you too.
Wow. I think Maya Angelou was correct.
So you say every road has brought you to the place you are now, but it was the silence of nature that really made you realize that love has always been there just when you needed it. So how did that love show up for you? What did it look like?
Well, I think again, in sort of reviewing my life, then you realize, I realized how many times when I didn't have two parental figures that were not having the roles of pushing me forward, that people seem to always step into my life to fulfill that role. I mean, I think, for lack of a better word, I would call them angels. And people always stepped in. And I think that this was a really big lesson for me. And also, nature was incredibly healing for me because it forced me to be a meditative person. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. I mean, I'm a person that has lived in big cities, and I'm totally type A and OCD and anything you want to say about low impulse control. And I just really, really had to reflect. And then you see, when you see how nature works, the complexity of nature and how everything has a purpose, and you're really looking at that every day, then you realize that everything sort of, or I came to the conclusion that everything happens for a reason. And I saw this with, you know, the people that walked into my life, too.
Hmm.
There's an interconnectivity that cannot be denied. At least I felt that. And I think more people should feel it, but I don't think we give the time or the space to actually see it.
Right, right. Well, I'm a big nature fan too, and for me it's very healing. And if I find myself, you know, getting uptight, which I have the last couple of weeks just because there's been so much going on, it's like I suddenly think,
right,
I need to get to the headland and just feel the wind and hear the wind and nothing else.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you at some point left, you stayed there, 6 years, and then you left. Why did you leave? I mean, it's very hard to make these big moves. Somebody who's not, you know, some people never move from state to state. That's a big enough move. When you move to a foreign country, that's a whole other thing. And now you've moved to a whole other country. You've moved to Britain or England.
I know.
So what made you...
land of your people. I moved actually when I started to realize that I felt like the lesson had been learned for me, and then I also realized that given my age at my late 40s at the time, that I actually did need to sort of go back to a bit of a bigger city or a bit of a more connected life in terms of being in a place that was a little bit more familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to work. I mean, this is just reality. So I had thought about, you know, I was doing projects in London, and then I really wanted to have a relationship. So I was also thinking about that, and I ended up meeting a British man in London. And after a couple of years of him coming up to the Arctic and me flying down, somebody had to make the move, and so I did. So I drove with my reindeer herding dogs and my two cats to the south of England from the Arctic. I think it's like a whole separate book.
Yes, that sounds like a whole separate book. And I love your dogs. I love that you took them with you. I was like, please don't leave your dogs behind.
No, oh my God, I would never do that. No, I'm the person that brought my shelter cats from New York to the Arctic, which I think a lot of people felt like, oh, who is this lunatic?
No, I get it.
But yeah.
Well, the book is called Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Laura?
Just, I hope that people think about the possibility in their lives. And when you feel like you're in a small moment of desperation, please know there is a much bigger picture waiting to unfold for you. I never could have imagined that I would have been somebody that would live in the Arctic for 6 years. So this is why life is amazing.
But think of all the great stories you're going to have to tell when you're older.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, we're all works in progress, so that's the way I see it. So
exactly. Actually, you came up with the perfect thing to say, and that's what I would actually like to say. We're all works in progress.
Yeah. Well, Laura Galloway, pleasure talking with you. I thank you for being with us today. And I know listeners can find out much more at your website, which is, I believe, authorlauragalloway.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
And if they're interested in pictures of the Arctic and things like that, I have an Instagram account where I put a lot of photos from my time in the Arctic. It's author Laura Galloway.
Awesome. Thank you, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.